The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of Spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello and welcome. Here comes another Books of the Year podcast from your friends at Books of the Year. That's us.
That is us. We're back again.
And our extensive production team, hundreds of people bring the show to you.
So many. So massive team.
Read every single book that comes out worldwide.
All of them. They're all stored in the British Library and that team goes through every book and then we decide to bring those books to you.
That's right. So there's a massive filtration process.
Oh, huge.
Remember, it's the fish that John West reject that makes John West Salmon the best. That's our motto. It's the books of the year reject that makes Books of the Year the best.
I always used to think that tagline was far too complicated, the John West one. And I'm sure they've changed it.
I've remembered it, though.
Yeah, you've remembered it, but you always have to sort of go the ones that they reject that makes the best fish. And you're like, just say, we've got really good fish. That's what
I'm reassured to know that they've gone through the fish.
Yes.
They've looked at the fish and they've said, first of all, you're not salmon. You're cod roe.
Yes. So,
for example,
you're out and you are not as good a salmon as we would like.
Yes.
So you're out.
So therefore,
yeah,
I felt reassured, even though I wasn't a huge fan of salmon.
No.
Would you know what beef hass is?
Beef hass?
Yeah. I ordered a beef hass vindaloo on Friday.
No.
Well, it turns out it's a fish. Because I thought it's going to be beef, is it?
Yeah.
You know, I looked it up. It's like a...
Is that all one word, beef?
No, it's two words, and it's like a shark, dogfish kind of thing.
Oh, right. Okay. Is that what we all now have to eat because there's no more
Something
cod?
Like that.
Right, okay.
Anyway, it's the beef hass
that
we reject that makes Books of the Year far more palatable
it is
than other books
so
podcasts.
True. Yeah.
Anyway, if you're a new listener...
it's like this all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
There are lots of other episodes where we make more sense.
Yeah.
If you'd like to treat yourself. An email from Grace Mitchell, who emailed booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. Hello, Simon. Hello, Matt. Finally got around to reading Mad Honey by Jodie Picoult and Jennifer Finney Boylan. This is from a few months ago.
It is a while ago, yeah.
And wow, capital letters, exclamation mark. You were not wrong. It really is one of the books of the year. Well, last year now. I would never have picked... Was it last year? Wow.
That is, yeah. That feels
I would
so
never
long
have
ago.
Picked this up had I not heard the authors chatting on the podcast, and I'm so glad I did. It's unbelievable to me that this book, as with many of Jodie's and Jenny's, are banned in schools in America. Everyone should read this book. I really loved it, so thank you for the recommendation, says Grace. I wonder if it's banned in America, you should automatically buy it.
Yeah, it's sort of a good sign, isn't it?
Unless it's the Anarchist Handbook, in which case, probably don't.
Isn't that the cookbook? Isn't that the one where you're not allowed out in prison, are you? Well, I'm going to guess you're not allowed.
When I was writing the Itch books, I downloaded like bits of the Anarchist
Handbook.
Yeah, I wanted details about
Bomb making.
Yes, essentially.
Yeah.
Because I wanted it to feel as though I had done some work, right, which okay. I had done. But I was thinking all the time, I shouldn't be looking at this.
Yeah.
Someone is going to come knocking on my door.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And don't do that on the work PC would be my advice. A message from Finn. I very much enjoyed your pod chat with Catriona Ward, who's a writer I didn't know of until listening to Books of the Year. She said that she sometimes just jumps on a train so she can write. And I love the idea of this. You often ask your guests where they like to write, and I'd like to know if you two have favourite places to work or write, etc. So, Simon, where do you do your writing?
Well, I used to always think that I had to be in the same place, and tried to be, but like we just had a week off, for example, mm-hmm. and I had like a whole section of a new book to try and finish, and I was sitting in my usual place, and it just wasn't that. So I moved around the house, and then the Wi-Fi went. So upsticks took the laptop, went and sat in the local pub with Wi-Fi, bought some non-alcoholic drinks because it was like 11 in the morning.
Okay.
And I'm not in an airport, I'm on a lad's holiday. And it was fantastic. And it was like the change of scenery, the change of vibe, the change of groove. I don't know what it was. And I then did the best work that I did in the whole week. So I think the honest answer to that is I used to have to be in the same place. But as long as I've got headphones to block out noisy people and other stuff,
okay.
I think I can actually work pretty much anywhere now.
Do you need to have something that you're looking at? In other words, or do you definitely not want to have like a window or a room that you're looking at? Would you far rather have, I think Stephen King likes to have a wall right in front of you so there's nothing to distract you.
I quite like that idea we had last time about the idea of putting two things either side of your laptop.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, no, so I think I'm inherently more flexible. What about you?
Well, so I write in the shed, and I write in the shed because we don't get Wi-Fi in the shed. So I'm not going to get distracted there. Oh. So I can only, because I am going to be, if my phone starts pinging, I'm not disciplined enough to not...
I'm amazed your Wi-Fi gets anywhere at all.
Yeah.
It's notoriously terrible.
But it definitely doesn't get down the garden into the shed. So, but the problem with the shed, obviously, is it's freezing. So it basically means from, you know, February through till November, I can write then, but outside of that, you know, November through to February, it's not a chance.
Why don't you buy a small heater?
Well, because those are ridiculously expensive, those things. They burn through. I may as well be lighting notes and using those to warm me rather than buying one of those ridiculous heaters. Also, they stay on. And I'm bound to leave it. All right, there you go.
Yeah, hopeless case.
Have more of my money, EDF.
If you'd like to get in touch, not EDF. aren't they French?
They are French. Yes. Yeah, you'd think that would make them more.
You can email us, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We would like to hear from you. That would be a very nice thing. You can tweet us at Books of the Year. We're on Instagram, at Pick Any Page. Cecilia Hearn time is now. Here we go. So we've been joined by Cecilia Hearn, multi-million selling author, globally recognised. What's that noise?
What was that noise?
Oh, no. How do I turn that off?
Is that you? Is that another government alert?
Did you get that yesterday?
Yeah.
I forgot about it until it happened.
If it's your agent, just tell them to back off. So as I was saying, a multi-million book-selling, internationally acclaimed author, Cecilia Hearn, is joining us in a spectacularly pink and blue jumper, I think.
Pink and purple. Pretty colourful.
See, the colours are relevant, as you're about to discover. Cecilia, it's very nice to speak to you. I think it was the Marble Collector the last time we spoke.
That's correct. And it's very, very nice to speak to you. Thank you.
Very nice to have you back on the show. So, Matt, describe the book. Let's judge this book by the cover.
Yeah, let's do that.
Tell us.
Because the colours on this cover, very important. So we have got a picture of a woman with her back to us, and she's sitting in a floral print dress, sitting on a bed. But the important thing here is that the left of the picture is very, very monochrome. and faded and not interesting, but it blends into a very, very colourful picture as it goes across to the right. It's all standing out. And there we have the title. We all see the world, ... in a thousand different ways, and Cecilia Ahern in white at the bottom, and some nice things said by Louise O'Neill and Donald Ryan at the top. And the reason why we know this is a classy cover is because you have a figure there and you can't see their face. And it's so long since we've had a cover like that, because so many times now people aren't putting figures on their cover, but they must never show their face for it to be a classic.
This is true. If they're looking away from us, it's a literary work. And if we can see their face... if we can see their face, the alarm goes off.
Yeah. Yeah.
I turned it off, guys. I'm so sorry.
So the title is In a Thousand Different Ways, and the We See the World bit has an ellipsis after it. So maybe to sort of give context to the title, just tell us about the title and why you've gone with this. Just introduce us to the book via the title, Cecilia.
So the title actually comes from an Oscar Wilde quote, which is a very long quote that I'm going to shorten. Mere colour speaks to the soul in a thousand different ways. And I had many, many titles that my publishers didn't like, but this is the one that we all liked. So it is about a character who has the ability to see people's moods and emotions in the form of colours around their body. So she can see their auras. But not only can she just know how someone is feeling just by looking at them, but if the colour travels to her or lands on her, then she can also feel exactly how people are feeling. So I wanted to write a book about what it's like to be empathetic, what it's like to be highly sensitive. And for people who aren't, because there are many who aren't, I thought that if I could describe emotions as colour and make it more visual, then it would be easier to see how moods and feelings are transferred. So that's where all the colour comes into it. It's a very colourful book.
It is, which explains the way Matt was describing the cover. So my understanding, Cecilia, is that this idea sat in your head for a couple of years before you put everything together to write this. Is that true? Did you have like half an idea and you had to wait for the final version?
Yeah, that's true. And that's usually what happens. I always come up with the idea first, the concept, and then I tried to figure out what kind of character would find themselves in that position. But I had this idea, I want somebody to be able to see moods and emotions in the form of colours, but I didn't know who that would be. And when I was pregnant with my third child a couple of years ago, I started experiencing these aura migraines, and I don't know if anyone's ever had them. They're quite frightening at first. They have stroke-like symptoms, and then you also see this bright light in your eye. Well, I saw this very bright light in my eye that kind of kept changing, and got a fright. I was sent to a neurologist to explain to me that they're aura migraines, and that also Lewis Carroll also experienced them, and which makes sense, you know, when you look at Alice in Wonderland. A lot of that is exactly how you feel actually when you have an aura migraine, you know, things that look further away, that are very, you know, things that are far away feeling very close, and the opposite, and then the kind of garbled language of the Mad Hatter. Anyway, I am going off on one.
not really, because this seems to me to get to the heart of Alice and why you wanted to write the book. Yeah. Just on the subject of these aura migraines.
That's also why I called her Alice, by the way, because I felt the link between it.
Ah.
Yeah, so when I was speaking to him, I realised that we're all wired so differently, and that I wanted to write this story, but not have it be a fantasy book or, you know, a magical book where someone sees colours. It's not supernatural. I really wanted it to be grounded in what a lot of people do experience. And I know I have exaggerated it in lots of ways, but I wanted it to come from something that could possibly be hormonal, neurological, you know, or that word that I still can't say, synesthesia. So that kind of gave me my way into telling the story. Just from having that experience myself, I realized, okay, I can create a character who's not magic, but just is wired differently.
You're very certain about that point through the book, aren't you, Cecilia? About if Alice is, she meets a Reiki. Is it Reiki healer? Is that how you say it? And she's very skeptical. When she meets faith healers, she thinks they're frauds. And there's a context, sort of, this is quite late in the book, where they're discussing and looking up biofields and Googling, do humans generate a magnetic field? So just could you just talk a bit more about wanting this to feel a realistic book and not a magic realist book?
Yeah, I wanted to explain that this is what happens for a lot of people. You know, I know people who, when they hear music, they see colours, and they or, you know, someone who hears numbers and hears numbers as colours. And I wanted to explain that this isn't exactly as you said, it's not kind of supernatural, but that everything has an energy. We know that everything has an aura. And you know, and they say birds, migrating birds, actually, that could be a possibility as to how they find their way around, because they're following, I'm not a scientist now, I don't know how to explain this, but that they're following kind of the energy fields, and that they can see it and we can't, but that some people have the ability to see people's magnetic fields. So I was trying to explain it in terms of, you know, the earth has one, and so people also have them, and sometimes people, animals, birds can see them. So I was trying to offer every possible realistic solution as to how this could happen.
Well, and that's part of the reason why I really bought into it, Cecilia, because I really, really like the book, and it's somewhat surprised because auras and things like that really, really, really aren't my thing normally.
As soon as we got to auras, I thought, okay, Matt's not going to like
it. I mean, I've been very unlucky in that the people that I've talked to who talk about auras have all been intensely irritating in every other aspect of their life. So, and so I've been really unlucky with that, and I'm not slagging it off. I'm sure it's all fabulous. However, I really, really enjoyed your book, Cecilia, and I put it down to two things. One is the writing, and it is also, we should say this very early on, it's also very funny. There were lots in this that really made me laugh. But, and this is, I thought, well, it was certainly crucial for me in buying into it, was, and you've touched on this slightly already, is that there is a degree of cynicism about certain aspects of the sort of what I might call the sort of woo-woo element. So Reiki, whatever. There's like one practitioner of that who is clearly a fraud, but we meet someone else later on who seems to know what they're doing. And it struck me that this is something that is, it's sort of open to abuse, because we can't right now prove that these things are there or not. And so it's open to people, you know, taking the mickey, basically, taking people's money and actually not doing anything at all. This is a roundabout way of me saying the book acknowledges that there is some BS around this subject, but we are living in a world in this book where Alice has this power. So was that something that you wanted people like me, who are a little bit cynical and cold-hearted and all of that, to buy into the book that way?
Yeah, I mean, well, it wasn't. I didn't do it deliberately in that way, but I think I wanted to balance it. Even within me, I'm cynical and I'm also a believer. So there's things that I think are possible, but I want to know how they are. You know, I suppose I don't believe in, it can be very airy-fairy going down this route, but and all alternative therapies and things like that, and some of them I kind of roll my eyes, and then others I really invest in. And I think it's with more research and more understanding of how these things are possible that I start to believe in them. And then also there's a gut feeling or an instinct that you think, well, this feels right. I can't explain it. It just feels right. But yeah, I didn't want to write a book that felt airy-fairy, you know. I wanted to be grounded, and I think that's the only way that it would work, because you know, even the character doesn't want it. She doesn't want to have this skill. You know, she feels that it's a burden, it's not a gift. She doesn't want to know how people feel. And one thing that was very interesting to me when I was writing is discovering that empathy does not equal compassion. You know, just because you feel what other people are feeling doesn't mean that you have to care. So I was taking something that felt quite emotional, but also trying to harden it. You know, it could be very, she could have gone down the route of helping characters. And I thought about that. I was like, maybe she has this skill and she starts to help people in trouble. And I just kept thinking, no, you know, she doesn't want to. She doesn't want to help people. This isn't, it's not going in that kind of nice route. It's really, she's wants to shield herself from other people. So yeah, I did want to keep balancing that softness kind of with a little bit more realistic hardness.
So Alice is the person who tells the story. You've written it in the first person. So when we join the story. She's very young, primary school age, and we go through her teenage years and into being an adult. I was intrigued by the process there by which you, the extent to which you changed the way Alice writes so that we believe her as a primary school kid, that we then believe her as a teenager, we then believe her as an adult. Did you change your writing at all? Did you use longer words? It's only something that occurred to me as I was walking down here, that to tell a story, first of all, from a very young child into adulthood in first person seems like quite a challenge.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, actually, if I thought about it like that, I think I would have really struggled. But when I'm writing, I feel, this sounds odd, but I do feel like I hear the voice of the character and I'm just writing. So I suppose writing as a child, I hear how a child would speak, and that kind of the innocence of explaining things that are happening, but not perhaps knowing the why, you know, and then as you get older, understanding the why things are happening. So, yeah, I did have to change, but she was always a very mature child as well because of what she was experiencing. She was seeing a lot more than other kids and feeling a lot more. So she did always have a mature voice, but it did have to grow throughout.
Maybe just a way of explaining it. Can you describe the scene that's very early in the book? In fact, it's the first time that we really understand that Alice has got this gift when she's seeing what she thinks is a terrible scene involving her mother and she calls the police. Can you just explain a little bit about that opening?
Yeah, so she's 8 years old and she arrives home from school and the curtains are still closed and the blinds are still down as usual. And she always feels a kind of sense of dread going home. Her mother has, well, undiagnosed at the time as bipolar disorder. And so Alice never knows what mood her mother is going to be in. She arrives home and she just sees kind of a blue mist, a fog drifting out from under the door, rolling down the stairs. And she goes upstairs, opens the door, and the room is very, very cold and covered in a blue colour. So she calls the ambulance and hides so that the blue doesn't get on her. And she tells them that her mother is blue. Of course, they race out thinking something terrible has happened, but they don't see anything. And when she tells them my mother was blue, they realise, oh, her mother was feeling blue, and they don't quite understand what she means, because her parents have just split up and her mother is blue and has been sleeping an awful lot and not leaving her room. So that's how the colour first begins. And then it spreads to her brother, who she starts to see as pink, and then her little brother, who takes all the colours from his mother. And from then on, it develops and moves to all her friends and everybody around her.
It's a very arresting first scene, that, Cecilia. And it also, again, you've touched on this, but I want to explore it a little bit more, is you came up with a nice twist, which I think really works in the book, where these colours, when they're coming out of a certain person, will infect other people around them without them knowing it. So the sort of red of anger will be transformed, will find its way from the mother to the son, and in fact Alice will physically move out of the, she can see these red darts coming towards her and she will physically get out of the way. And I just, talk to us about that, because it was as soon as you started talking about it in the book, it absolutely sort of started drawing me in, of this idea that it wasn't just surrounding one person, but it's these are colors trying to attack others.
Yeah. So I really had fun with the fact that colour is like, there are other characters in this book and they have personalities and they have movement. So they move, they twirl, they swirl, you know, they have her mother's anger, you know, can be sometimes like tornado or like an octopus tentacle, like reaching out, trying to catch her. She feels that they're angry and they're scary. They're like monsters to her, you know, but then there's other nicer colours, you know, that she sees of love and joy and things like that, that are more gentle. But yeah, they have character. And the reason why I wrote that actually is because I would consider myself to be sensitive. I'm an empath and at times highly sensitive. And sometimes I do feel that whatever moods other people are in, it just transfers to me. And or even if somebody says something mean, then, you know, or angry, then I just feel like I take it. and I carry it on. And so I wanted to show how that can happen. It does happen. You know, we know what it's like to walk into a room and feel a good energy or feel a bad energy. And it's like we take that on ourselves and bring it somewhere else. So it was important to me that colour had, and it's not just one colour. Everyone has lots of colours. As she gets older, the colours develop, and because people have many emotions, not just one, and people have many layers, that she starts to, it becomes a whole new language that she has to read and learn how to speak.
The idea of passing on a mood, when we were kind of engaging with that in the book, Cecilia, it reminded me, I think it was my driving instructor, so going back a long, long time. So if you use your horn, if you're angry and you use your horn, you are, I mean, sometimes, obviously, you need to do it and you're using it correctly. Yeah. But if you're using it randomly and stupidly, just because you're frustrated, you are literally passing on your anger. So your anger is there. You've then passed it on. That driver is now passing, is now angry. And who knows how he or she is going to pass it on. So in a very practical sense, you can pass on your mood to somebody else.
Absolutely. And also, she has two brothers. Ollie is her oldest brother. Ollie is her baby brother, and Hugh is her older brother. And I also wanted to show how, you know, we can all live in the same environment, but come out of it differently. We're all affected by the same situation in our family lives or in our home lives. Hugh manages to, the colours go straight over his head. For Alice, she's dodging, she's ducking and diving and trying to dodge all of these colours. And for Ollie, the little boy, he's absorbing all of the colours. And we're all just made so differently that we all are affected by different situations in various different ways. And I just wanted to show how different people can accept energy or reject energy.
Did you have a colour code that was your guide? You know, certain moods, certain ideas, do they always go with particular colours?
Yes. Yeah, I did a lot of research about what different aura colours meant. But, you know, to be very honest, sometimes if you go to a different, you know, the same colours can mean different things to different people. But I had to create my own kind of colour code. And then within the colours, the shades had different meanings. So, you know, blue, as I explained, was her mother's sadness. But then there was a different shade of blue, which could be like a conservative blue or the lovely blue of a natural leader. You know, there were so many different shades of colours. I introduced like metallic flashes of colours for rage or for sarcasm. If something is luminous and not quite natural, then it's a negative. It was a negative colour. And, you know, gold is the ultimate, but a lot of people try to be gold, but they're not. They're tarnished or they're metallic. So, yeah, I did create this kind of, I had fun doing that, actually. But and then black is the most dangerous of all, you know, but then some people can be covered by a kind of veil of black if they're in grief. So it's not so dangerous. So, yeah, I did have this. Sorry, I could talk about colours for a long time.
No, no.
Not very exciting.
but that also comes into the sort of superpower element of this, because she does have this sort of superpower. She at one point she senses that something's going on in the room next to her, where there's her neighbour, and her neighbour has, there's a man in there, and it seems, you know, to the normal observer, everything is fine in that room. But as soon as the door opens, Alice is able to see that there is just black surrounding, pooling off this guy, and she knows his intentions are absolutely nefarious, even though he hasn't revealed them yet. And here's what struck me. So we had Joanne Harris on the podcast recently, and she is sort of in the same sort of genre in that she had a book where a character was able to see into people as if it was their house. So in other words, walking into a house and their front room and see the corners that they wouldn't normally, or cupboards that they wouldn't normally show to outside people. And you've already spoken about how you see yourself as a bit of an empath. But is this superpower of being able to see the good or bad in other people without the normal cues that we normally get, the, you know, the sort of things we can all sense, but she sees them instantly. She sees that colour straight away. There is danger. Don't trust this guy. Guy knocks on her door and starts talking to her about her roof. And she knows straight away from the colour that he's trying to diddle her. That kind of thing. And is it, was there a superpower element when you were writing this of just, you know, the ability to instantly see what someone's intentions are?
Well, I think that superpower can often be female intuition as well. You know, I think that, and not that men don't have it, but I can't say that they do because I'm a woman. But I think a lot of the time, you know, the way we're raised as well to watch out for that kind of feeling, you know, that, you know, if you're in the same room as someone or someone's around and it doesn't feel right, then it's not right. And I think I wanted to really push that even further. You know, if you're walking down the road and there's someone behind you, or that feeling that you get that it's something very dangerous and you need to just leave, I think every woman is encouraged to follow that instinct. So it is like a superpower. But and often at times you don't have to be super to have that feeling. It's very normal. And or you can feel it. I remember, you know, on a bus, you know, when someone sits down beside you and you feel something's not right, and you need, you know. So that's, I just think, are human instincts. But definitely pushed, but by introducing color, it makes it seem very, very, you know, it's not an everyday thing, but there are certainly the feelings that a lot of people would have when they're in the company of others.
Matt's already referred to how well written it is. It is fantastically written, this book. And I was amazed that you time and time again found the language to describe what Alice is seeing, because in lesser hands, it would be, you know, here's a blue thing, here's a red thing, here's a green thing, it's a swirly thing, you know. But every time you come to a scene, it feels magical. And I wondered if that just didn't just come because you're a fantastically gifted writer, but it just, the more you write in colour, the more you think in colour, maybe the easier it gets.
Yeah. I felt it was... It did feel very natural, you know, and certainly for instances like introducing a lawyer who had colours moving from side to side, like the balance of justice, is that it?
Yeah.
Balance of justice. You know, she had logical yellow and that conservative leader blue that I spoke about going up and down as she's trying to make a decision. I think I just looked at every character, and they say everybody has a base colour. You know, I thought about that, and then I thought about what are the kind of colours that would kind of inform who that person is, or the way they think and the way they feel. So it actually, in that way, made it very easy, to be honest. I found it was a very visual book, and I just threw myself into it and was able to come up with lots of different scenarios all the time. I don't know how else to answer it. I felt it came very easily to me, because I think I'm a very visual writer. You know, so I'm seeing the story I'm writing, and then I'm just writing it down. So I watch my stories in my head all the time, and this felt just incredibly visual.
It's just, you know, you feel as though there are ways of describing colour. We only have the words that we have to describe red and black and blue, but it sounds as though what Alice is experiencing is so much greater than that. You know, it's almost that, although you're telling us the colours, that she's almost seeing new colours, which obviously we don't have the language to describe.
Yeah, that's true. And she's feeling the heat of them as well. You know, some are hot and then some are cold, and it's a larger experience for her. And not only is she seeing them, but she's feeling them. So she's going about her life, you know, feeling perfectly happy, and then someone's anger, you know, someone can bump into her feeling anger, and then she's suddenly feeling their anger. Then she's suddenly feeling someone else's jealousy or bitterness, or, you know, and then someone else's joy. So she's kind of suffering a lot from feeling everybody else's emotions. And I think I wanted to show, just push it in every different angle to show how intense it is for her. She has to wear sunglasses because the colors are so bright. You know, she learns how to shield herself actually, it's funny that you mentioned superpower. When she's a teenager and she's in this behavioral school where she's sent because nobody really understands her, he calls her a superpower, and he says, be careful, because every superhero has an arch nemesis, and you're going to have to figure out who that nemesis is and watch out for them. And no spoilers, but she does does discover that her arch nemesis can be herself. You know, the very, very opposite of herself is also herself. So she needs to protect herself from herself. And I think we can all be our own worst enemies as well. And that was kind of the point I was making. But yeah.
And,
did I answer it?
No, absolutely you did. I wondered, does part of the intensity of the book, Cecilia, come from the fact, I think you wrote this during the second lockdown, which was a pretty intense experience for everybody, whatever they were doing. But when you look back on the book, and I think you've said elsewhere that this is, you think it's the best novel that you've ever written. I wonder if some of the intensity came from your personal situation.
It really did, you know, it really, really did. I always throw my heart and soul into writing my novels, but I just think I emptied the tank completely into this one. And I wasn't just in a pandemic. I was postnatal and perimenopausal. I had a lot of things going on in the pandemic, and I was feeling a lot of things. And I think a lot of, even if you're not a very feeling person, I think during the pandemic, we were all feeling the heaviness of everyone around us. It was such an emotional time. So I feel like that was intensified for me, and just really enjoyed pouring it all into this novel. And I'm not the character, and it's not my journey, but I was able to put a lot of that kind of quest for balance and how I felt, kind of, I was feeling all the energies of everyone around me, put it into this book.
So I'm aware that you're not a scientist. I'm not a scientist. No. Matt is not a scientist. But at the end of your book, do you think that, and also bearing in mind what you were saying about your own aura migraines, is there some interaction between hormones and neurons? You know, you were talking about neurological and hormonal. I just wonder, is that what's at play here, do you think?
Yeah, with this character, so there's that, but there is my instinctive feeling as a writer that this this came about as a form of survival for her, that this was formed by the environment that she was living in, that Alice from such a young age was trying so desperately to know what kind of mood her mother was going to be, that she was reading and she studied her so hard that she understood exactly what her, just by looking at her mother, how she felt. And I think the skills then developed from there. I think everything else I've offered are possibilities scientifically to please people like you who hate the woo-woo airy-fairy stuff. But character-wise, I think it's from her environment. She's a product of her environment. She's trying to survive. And these are the skills that come about because she literally just wants to know what mood her mother's going to be in and how she needs. She's kind of walking on eggshells around her and very hesitant and reluctant and is in a very scary place for a child. So I think that's, for me, that's where it develops. But everything else can explain it too.
So the quotes on the book then should read, "Beautiful, moving, unforgettable, Louise O'Neill. There's gold on every page, Donal Ryan. And there's very little woo-woo, Matt Williams."
And, you know, that's really important as well, because I think writing a book like this can, you know, it can put a lot of people off and because it seems so unrealistic and it's not real. And that is what I was trying to, as a writer, I really love to look at what if, you know, and without going so far that I scare people away, I always need to ground it and bring it back again. So that is very important that you feel that, you know.
The new book from Cecilia Ahern is In a Thousand Different Ways. There'll be more with Cecilia on our next podcast, which will be with you in a few days' time when she's doing the question and answer session. For the moment, Cecilia, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much.